This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Autumn is here, season of mists and unmellow conferences. All the major parties will be gathering to network, speechify and hone their messages. And this year, they know that they're unlikely to meet again before the next election. But just as they will be trying to tell us, the voters, who they are, they will be wondering who we are. Because one thing that is certain is that we won't be exactly the same electorate that they faced back in 2019. We will have changed in experience, in attitude, quite a few of us will have died, new voters will have been added to the rolls. So as the election approaches, who are we now? Step into the briefing room, today enlarged to include an audience here at the BBC Radio Theatre, and together we'll find out. To chart us through this voyage of discovery, we have Paula Surridge, Professor of Political Sociology at the University of Bristol, Rosie Campbell, Professor of Politics at King's College London, and Rob Ford, Professor of Political Science at the University of Manchester. Right, the first question is the question about class, because when I was growing up, it was assumed that people would vote largely according to class and that that class had been transmitted through their families. So if I can start with you, Rosie, first. What role does class play now in determining political allegiance?
Well, there's a danger we could draw the wrong conclusion from how much things have changed in that very short time since you were a little boy. Because at that time, you know, when you say you could predict your party from your class, we're really talking about the two main parties at the time, Conservative and Labour. If you had a working class identity, you would vote Labour mostly, about two-thirds of the working class, and vice versa, middle class would vote Conservative. Now, that old, simple relationship is no more. There's a real danger that we then conclude that class doesn't matter at all anymore. And it really does shape how we react to parties and policies, but it's intercepted by other factors like our age and where we live and the fact that that old loyalty you described, my dad, my mum always voted for this party, I will always vote for this party, has really declined. But class still plays a role. I think some of my other colleagues will have really detailed answers on this.
Will you, Rob Ford?
Probably. It's one of the subjects I could talk about for longer than this show is due to run. But if I could make two points about how it's changed. The first is we in Britain tend to be very vague when we talk about class, and academics don't like vagueness. So when academics say class has declined, what they mean is the role of occupation has declined. So, you know, the guy on the factory floor versus the guy in the management office, that kind of understanding of class, what you're doing, what sort of characteristics your job has, how secure it is and so on, that doesn't predict our voting behaviour so much anymore. But it does predict something else. It predicts whether you show up to vote at all. So there's quite a strong relationship between class and turnout in elections, which is because a lot of working class voters have turned their backs on participating in elections. But also we often use class in a slightly different way, which is to mean the resources you have. Do you have a house? Do you have a good income? Can you take a holiday and so on? And if we look at things like home ownership or income, then the relationship is still pretty strong there between those kinds of senses of class and how you vote. The more resources you have, the better off or more privileged you are, the more likely you are to vote for the Conservatives. The more deprived you are of these things, the more likely you are to vote Labour, with one recent exception, which we'll come on to later, which is education.
OK, Paula Surridge.
The way that we think about class might have changed a little bit, but some research we've done recently suggests that people still use class as a filter to understand politics. So we asked people which key divides were still important in British politics, and the choices included middle class versus working class, left versus right, leave versus remain, also old versus young and some other things. And those first three got about a quarter of the sample each saying they were the most important. In fact, marginally, the middle class, working class divide was the top one. So people still use that as a filter through which they understand their politics and they understand their parties and their politicians.
When we ask about political identity later in the programme, we'll find out about some other factors, if you know, how people see themselves. But what about the objective factors which have been predictors of voting habit? I suppose we should start with age, Paula.
Yeah, so we've seen a large age gradient develop in British politics. So YouGov calculate what they call a tipping point, the point along the age scale where you're more likely to vote Conservative than Labour. In 2017, that was age 47. 2019, that was age 39. I mean, if anybody wants me to have a bit of a bet on where that's going to be in 2024, or to look at the polling today, that's creeping back up, and it may actually, I think, go higher than 47 at the next election. But age has become this really big determinant, but it's not the only factor. And at the moment, what we're seeing is a sort of change from when we last talked about this that's affected all age groups. But because the youngest age group was so much more likely to be Labour supported in the first place, it's starting to tilt that age gradient back in the opposite direction a little bit.
Rob?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing to bear in mind about age is that it connects to a lot of the other things that now predict vote choice, but it actually has an effect on top of that. So age is connected to education because education has expanded a lot in the past few decades. It's connected to ethnic diversity because younger cohorts are more ethnically diverse. It's connected, of course, to home ownership in a big way now, in a way that wasn't true 20 years ago. And all of those things linked to vote choice and help to feed this very strong age divide that we have. But even if you put all of those things into the big statistical blender and sort of pass out their effects, you're still left with a really strong age effect. And that's because now, in a way that wasn't true a generation or two ago, age is very strongly linked to the values people hold and the identities that matter to them most. And those things have fed into the way people vote a lot more in the last 10 years or so than was true earlier.
Well, this raises the inevitable question of whether or not this is something that changes as people get old, in other words, they change their minds, or whether what you've got is younger generations who have attitudes which they might continue to take with them as they age. And this is particularly important because actually, we have an ageing population.
Well, we can't be absolutely sure what's going to happen in the future, but if we look about trends around liberal versus authoritarian attitudes, for example, that has definitely been a cohort rather than an age effect. So actually, as older generations are dying and the younger generations replacing them are more liberal in their values. So we would expect them to continue to be more liberal through the life course. There is an ageing effect, but these two things sort of go along together. So what we are potentially seeing is that the older cohort that perhaps have more authoritarian values might be more in favour of the death penalty, for example. Those values are going to be disappearing from the electorate. That doesn't mean there won't be some shock at some point and things could change. But if we look at the trajectory as we see it now, that's what we'd anticipate.
It also doesn't tell you which parties they're going to vote for because parties can change their stance on those things. Rosie, since you're speaking at the moment, let's talk about gender.
Oh, thank you for getting me on my favourite hobby horse. So I've been looking at gender and voting for about 20 years. And for most of that time, very little was going on. So historically, women in this country were slightly more likely to vote Conservative than men. And then that gap kind of narrowed really substantially in the 1970s. And then internationally, a trend was happening where women, as they entered paid work and entered higher education, were moving to the left of men. So, for example, in the US, in every presidential election since 1980, a greater proportion of women have voted Democratic. And there's been lots of sense that this is a global trend, but it never happened in the UK until 2017. And in 2017 and 2019, it's the first point in the post-World War II period that a greater proportion of women have voted Labour than men. And that gap is really delineated by age. So when we talk about this age gap and younger voters being more likely to vote Labour, a huge part of that is younger women being more likely to vote Labour.
Could you hazard a guess as to why?
I think there are multiple factors. One key factor is economics. Unfortunately, we still do, despite all the progress that's been made, we still do live in a society where the economically most vulnerable are disproportionately women. So, for example, single-parent families, about 90% are women, and living disproportionately in poverty compared to other families. Low-paid, insecure work, disproportionately women. So there's a significant economic factor. But actually, when we look in the youngest age ranges, it's a bit harder to explain what's going on. So I've sort of described what I would think of quite optimistically is this sort of trend towards liberalism amongst younger generations. But actually, on some questions, we actually see the reversal. So if you look at the question, have efforts to promote gender equality gone too far? Actually, there's a big gap between younger men and younger women on that question, and actually a much bigger gap than there is in the older age ranges. So it's still a minority. About 20% of men aged 18 to 24 think those efforts to promote gender equality have gone too far, but that's twice as many as younger women.
Let's look at ethnicity and how important ethnicity is or isn't in determining allegiance. Rob?
Yeah, I mean, because we don't have surveys of representative samples of ethnic minorities, and incidentally, this is particularly a problem with ethnic minority communities because you have a lot of voters in those groups whose English is not necessarily the best and so on. So you have to take special steps to get a decent sample of them and be able to figure out how they're behaving as a whole. It's a more difficult group to survey, and we don't do it very often. But we can try and make some guesses, make some inferences from the way places behave as well, because ethnic minority communities tend to cluster together in particular places. And I just highlight two election results that suggest something interesting might be going on. One is Harrow in London, which has the largest proportion of Indian origin voters anywhere in London, and it's the only borough that the Conservatives took control of in the last local elections in London when the rest of London was swinging towards Labour. And the other is Leicester East, which has the highest proportion of Indian origin voters outside of London and had the largest swing against Labour in any ethnic diversity in the country in 2019. Now, both of those data points would suggest that the Indian origin community in Britain, which is the largest ethnic minority community, might be heading in the direction of the Conservative Party. And there's one good reason for that that predates our current Prime Minister, which is that this is also the most middle class of the ethnic minority communities, but also, of course, this is the community from which our first ever ethnic minority Prime Minister has come.
Rosie.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the distinctions when we have this poor quality data because we have too few people from ethnic minorities in the samples. But when we do pull it apart, one thing we see is that there is a very high rate of support for the Labour Party amongst African Caribbean voters. And I think one of the things that drives that is a legacy of the Conservative Party having alienated itself from those communities. And we think historically about Enoch Powell and Rivers of Blood, and then the party perhaps trying, you know, gradually to improve its reputation. And then we have Windrush. So I think you need to look very specifically at individual communities and how people within those communities have experienced their relationship with the political parties.
Let's look at education. How significant an indicator of possible political allegiance is the level to which you've been educated?
It's incredibly important now. Whether you have a degree or not is a really strong predictor of party support. It is delineated by the other factors, like where you live. You know, if you have a degree and a higher income and you live in a metropolitan area, you're very, very likely to support the Labour Party. But it's become a much more important factor than used to be. And it's obviously also interacts with age in that there are many more people in younger age groups who've got degrees.
Paula, how much of this is education? How much of this is age? Because in the past, you would have expected more highly educated people to be a bedrock of support for the Conservative Party.
It's more education than age. If you look at both of these things, if we borrow Rob's statistical blender for a minute and we put all these things in together, you tend to see that the education effects are stronger than the age effects, and they're across different age groups. It seems to have been driven primarily by this tilting of our politics to include this dimension that's about liberalism. Rosie called it authoritarianism, some people call it social conservatism. And that dimension is very strongly related to education. If you're more highly educated, you're much more likely to have liberal values.
Okay, Rob, does that suggest a kind of more transactional attitude in a way, with people saying, not I vote Labour because I tend to vote Labour, I have voted Labour in the past, but looking and saying, who's going to do what for me at the next election, no matter what I voted at the last election?
Well, I'm going to try something rather tricky on radio now and say that there are three things going on at once. The first is what you're talking about, which is that the tribal sense of party identity, this sense of not I vote Labour, but I am Labour, that has been in long-term decline. So there is lots less of that, which would suggest a more transactional politics. But there's something else that happened around about 2016 that interrupts that, which is we had a new sense of who we were and who we were not. I am Remain, I am Leave became a thing that people would spontaneously say. They still say it at roughly the same rates as they were saying it 7 years ago, and they still say it at rates far above what they say for the political parties. But what we've seen in the last couple of years is some evidence that whether or not that sense of I am Remain or I am Leave is actually going to drive your vote depends upon what else is going on in politics. I am Remain or I am Leave doesn't tell you what to do in terms of paying your bills. It doesn't tell you what to do in terms of getting a house. So people have moved back to the transactional economic agenda. And although those identities are still there in the background and could come back when the issue agenda changes again, right now they're not in the foreground. They're not driving how people are behaving.
Paula, Rob has slightly kind of moved us on as well towards this question of how important Brexit still is. And I suppose I'm wondering now whether the Brexit question became a kind of marker, but does that mean that Brexit itself continues to be important in how people think they might cast their political allegiance?
So it's still important for a particular group, largely of Remain voters, for whom that identity remains quite strong. Some polling we did, we asked people whether they'd rather vote for a party that was talking about Brexit or not talking about Brexit, and people prefer a party that's not talking about Brexit because people are, they're really concerned about the cost of living, they're concerned about interest rates, they're concerned about things that they don't see as being part of that agenda, and they want politicians to be talking to them about the things that feel like crises in their lives right now.
Okay, Rosie.
I think there's also another factor going on that we've talked a lot about how we feel as voters, but how what the parties offer us shapes how we behave. And I think there's a slight sense that Brexit's become like Voldemort. We dare not say its name. And the political parties, Labour and Conservative, both have reasons for not wanting to tip us into those identities. They want to get Remain and Leave votes. So better not to talk about it at all.
This brings us, I think, rather neatly to that geographical category, which has become known as the Red Wall, and which is, I kind of feel, sort of dominated political discussion and debate for certainly ever since the 2019 election, possibly since before then. Rob, what should we understand now from current polling and research about the Red Wall, what it is and where it's going?
Well, I mean, the Red Wall became a kind of subject of media and indeed academic fascination, I think, because it was kind of like the San Andreas fault line, where you had the kind of meeting of the fading old identities of politics, of class, of partisanship, I am Labour. These were very Labour-loyal places, but fading with the new fault line of Brexit. What the Red Wall became shorthand for was seats that had been Labour for a long time but had voted Leave. And if the Conservatives won them, then they would have a big majority. And so the question was, would old loyalties or new loyalties prevail? And as we saw, new loyalties to Brexit prevailed very strongly in those seats. And we saw very, very large swings, a lot of seats that hadn't been anything but Labour since the Second World War fell. What we've been seeing in more recent polling is that now the old loyalties might be reasserting themselves. This is not because these voters don't identify as Leave, they still do. But two things have happened. Firstly, they've been deeply disappointed by the Brexit that has arrived. It isn't what they were promised. It hasn't changed their lives in the ways that they thought it would. They accept that it has been done, but they think it has been botched. And secondly, they have also been deeply unimpressed by the Conservative government's performance on everything else, and that has then fed back into the traditional sense of distrust in the Conservatives that was still latent there all along. I mean, Boris Johnson himself said in his acceptance speech after the election, "You've lent me your votes." Well, it seems that loan is being called in.
OK, we just say before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one asking how much interest and influence China has in the UK, the one asking how much legal trouble Donald Trump is in, and the one asking whether it's going to be the Saudi century. Right, well, let's move on to values, issues and the wider political environment. We touched on a few of them a bit, but we'll look at them in more detail. Issues first, really. One of the issues that's been on the political agenda for some time is, it never really seems to go away, actually, is immigration. What's the current thinking, according to the polls, about how important the British people think immigration currently is and other factors around that? Rob?
Thank you, David. This is my hobby horse. We've had Rosie's hobby horse. This is my hobby horse. I did my PhD thesis on immigration politics 20 years or so ago. I've been looking at it ever since. And it is a really interesting point we've arrived at here, because a number of things, again, are all true at once. Firstly, immigration is much less important to voters now. It's much further down the hierarchy of issues than it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Back then, you'd get 50% plus of people saying it was the top issue or one of the top issues facing the country. Now it's more like 20 to 30%. Secondly, the public as a whole, Leave and Remain, has become more positive about the effects of immigration. They see it as an economic plus, they see it as a cultural plus in a way that was really never true in the polling right the way back to the 1960s. There was always a kind of entrenched scepticism about immigration in the public, much less so now. However, point number three, there's one group that is really sceptical about immigration and really quite agitated about it, and it's the people who voted Conservative in 2019. So this is why the Conservatives pay a lot of attention to this issue, because they know it's an issue that exercises their core electorate.
Paula, this would seem on the face of it to create something of a problem for the Conservative Party, because if it doesn't lead on the immigration issue in a big way, but if an important section of its voters still regards this as being very, very important, it's quite difficult to know how to strike the right balance.
It is. I mean, it's really striking now to see that when people are asked who they think would do the best job on immigration or who are most trusted on immigration, that Labour have a lead on that issue. I mean, that's something that we haven't seen for decades. But it does give the Conservatives a problem, because they've also got a small but noisy presence of Reform UK sort of to the right of them on immigration that can appeal to some of those voters. And those 2019 Conservative voters who think immigration is important, for whom, many of whom, it's the second or first most important issue, they say that the Conservatives are doing badly on it. So for the Conservatives to try and push it up the agenda because they think it's their issue could actually really work against them, because people don't trust them on it.
There's a further risk that we've talked a lot about Labour versus Conservative, but there are Liberal Democrat Conservative marginals. And in those seats, it's kind of Remain-oriented, not massively hostile to immigration, educated, liberal individuals who are a little bit to the right economically, that they will need to retain their votes or even gain their votes. So if you go really hard on an anti-immigration line, that also has potential risks.
Paula, let's look at the economy. You raised it earlier. The biggest change, arguably, since the pandemic is that we had this massive inflation with a multiplicity of causes and the cost of living crisis. Would we describe this as being easily the first and foremost issue for most voters in most groups?
Yes. And that's a very simple answer. It is by far the most important issue. Some express it as the cost of living. Some express it as the economy more generally, and if you disaggregate those, it can make them look like lower concerns. But it is the forefront concern of all groups. And I think it's important to note as well that we did some red wall, to coin a phrase, focus groups back in autumn 2021, and the cost of living was already an issue then. So it's not been a sudden kind of burst onto the scene. It's been an issue for people for really quite a long time, and it's remained the top of the agenda for people.
And has that been the case even when, say, there's been a lot going on in the NHS and the NHS has seemed to dominate the headlines? Is it still cost of living at that point?
Absolutely, yeah. The NHS is always a cause for concern, but it's usually people's second or third cause for concern. So if you look at their top three, the NHS shoots up there. But if you look at their number one priority, it's cost of living.
Rob, as an expert, are you of the it's the economy stupid school?
Well, history says yes, it's the economy stupid. If you want one variable that predicts a government losing, it's that they preside over an economic crisis. That's been true of practically every single government that's gone on to lose. The only exceptions are the ones who change leader. So the Conservatives maybe made the right decision in doing that, rather boxed the execution perhaps by doing it twice in quick succession. And the reason for that is the economy affects everyone and everything. So it's what we call a valence or competence issue. It makes everyone say, this lot are screwing up. And so you get a kind of tide going out across the board.
We did actually take a look at this a couple of years ago. And back then, we were talking much more about values than about the economy. So is it just true that the economy is by far and away the biggest issue when things are going badly and might go away if things are going better? Rosie?
Absolutely. And I think there is another dimension to it in terms of how exposed people feel. So everybody's really worried about the economy, but we've been talking a lot about age and class. But one thing that's a huge factor is home ownership, because some of the older voters who we might think of as not being especially privileged in terms of incomes, may not have degrees, own their homes and actually may be in the position where they can vote along values lines. That actually some of the wealthier in terms of incomes, people are very worried about interest rates and mortgages and high rent prices.
Rob?
If you want to divide the electorate up in terms of their housing status right now, you can divide it in the following way. There's the people who own their own home and have fully paid off their mortgage. They are still giving the Conservatives a lead. And there's everybody else. And all the other groups are giving Labour a lead of between 15 and 20%.
Paula, you're nodding.
One thing to bear in mind, though, when we talk about economics or values, but people have economic values, people have different ways that they'd like to see the economy organised, different ways that they'd like to see the pie sliced and so on. And so it's the interaction sometimes between people's views on the economy and their views on these other issues that becomes really important for voting.
Right. I just want to put in an awkward little question which occurs, which is, for some values of an election result, what happens in Scotland is going to matter quite a lot. And I'd just like to ask whichever of you wants to take on the question, what seems to be happening in Scotland and whether or not it might affect the result of the election in any significant way?
I'll give it a go. So in Scotland, I think you have got an interesting kind of parallel world, because you also have a realignment around a referendum, and you also have an incumbent governing party that has sort of surfed that realignment into quite a dominant position. And you also have a formerly very dominant incumbent party where the tide seems to be going out because they lost a leader under a cloud, had a bunch of scandals, and the new leader is not popular. And it's kind of similar to what's happening south of the border in that it is a general turning against a long-term incumbent, often on grounds of competence, but with those sort of tribal alignments from the referendum still kind of there in the background. But of course, the big difference in terms of the general election at Westminster is who's gaining from the tide going out for the SNP. It's Labour. And for every 10 seats that Labour are gaining in Scotland, and because the SNP votes quite evenly spread, they can get quite a lot with a big swing in Scotland, then that lowers the bar to clear in England. So although very often the conversation is focused on Labour versus Conservative, it's a different debate up there, but one that has really important knock-on effects for the state of Westminster.
That's a very good point at which to end. I'm always asked for a conclusion at the end of these programmes, and my conclusion is that I don't dare have a conclusion because the BBC will inevitably get complaints about whatever my conclusion is. Thanks, everybody, for that. And the nice thing about recording this in front of an audience is that we can take some of their questions. So if you would want to put your hand up, if you'd like to ask something, we'll try to get a microphone to you. And I'll start with the gentleman in the front here, because you're absolutely closest to me. If you could just say your first name when you ask your question, that'd be great.
David. There was no mention of tactical voting and what effect that may have.
Okay. Anybody done any work on tactical voting?
Oh, I think about tactical voting every night of my life.
It wasn't about whether you thought about it, it was whether you felt expert enough to answer a question about it.
Yes, I think so. I mean, it is very likely to be important in the next election because there are a lot of seats where it can matter. Because of the way in which voting has been sort of shaken up by the Brexit realignment that we've talked a little bit about on the show, there are a lot of places where you've got a big third place vote. And that's what tactical voting is, incidentally, for those of you who don't know. It's if your first choice party's third. So say you're a Labour voter, Labour are third in your seat. Seat I grew up with was like this, and it's Conservative versus Lib Dems. And you say, well, what I really want to do is to kick out the Conservatives, so I'll tactically vote for the Lib Dems, even though in an ideal world, I'd just be voting Labour. And if you run the numbers on this, then potentially if people behave like this consistently, it can deliver anywhere in the region of 30 to 40 or even more seats into the Labour column primarily, because there are a lot of seats that are Conservative first, Lib Dem second. So that means the big opportunity is that squeezed Labour vote.
Do either of you want to come back on that, or should we go to the next one?
I think I'd just add to it. Normally, I'm a bit sceptical about this. I normally think that the electorate don't really have enough information to make these judgments very clearly. But I think because the mood is to get a change of government and to get rid of the Conservative government, I think it could be a bigger factor than it might otherwise have been, because that's people's key motivation, is to get rid of that party rather than to express their support for another party.
Yes, that question from the lady there. Thank you.
My name's Catherine. I'd like to ask if there's any data on the influence of social media on particularly youngsters, and the very fact that they're not necessarily reading newspapers in depth, either in paper or online, but, you know, a lot of it is down to a soundbite culture and the persona and policies coming across through social media.
Paula, does the way in which people have changed, the way in which they get their information, do you think had any significant influence on their political allegiance?
Well, it's not an area of expertise for me, but we know that media effects are very strong. And I think Rob seems like he might have a better answer. Is that what your hand was delivering?
I was sort of gesticulating.
Yeah.
Some colleagues of mine, formerly of the University of Manchester, they now moved on, did some studies of this. And they found that social media is surprisingly weak in its effects on how people behave. And the big reason for that is, in particular, consuming political content on social media, as my kids are very fond of telling me, is a deeply sad thing to do. that most people using social media don't do. So the only people who engage with politics on social media tend to be people who have already got very strong political preferences. Now, social media can reinforce those, but it very seldom changes them.
Paula.
I don't think I have a great deal to add. I think the one thing that I would say with the question is that we have to think about what we mean by social media. Do we mean adverts from the parties? Do we mean campaigners? The thing that I found fascinating during the last election were the kind of local Facebook groups and the kind of political content, low-level political content that you would get in those. And they're really difficult to analyse. I've got no claim to know how they influence people, but it was very striking that you would see this kind of low-level political stuff creeping into these closed spaces and making it quite difficult for us actually to know what's going on.
So then, in a sense, that's an analysis to come. Yeah, okay. I think there's a person has the microphone up the back there.
Hi there, yeah, my name's Thomas. I've got a question about how voters react to the way we're governed. So both parties, whenever they're in government, pretty much wherever they are, tend to make decisions on the basis of quite a centralised model with quite short-term decisions, you know, small funding pots allocated by competition. And what you don't see is kind of large, long-term funding settlements and then experts able to make decisions on the basis of planning. That was typified a few weeks ago when there was a competition, I think, to win chess sets for schools from a national funding pot, while at the same time schools literally couldn't open because the roof was falling down. Presumably, governments think that voters would reward them for this behaviour, and I just wonder, is that the case as far as the research tells us?
I don't know how one would answer this question, but I suppose the question is, do voters have any sense of rewarding politicians who suggest that problems are long-term and actually suggest they'll forego short-term gains in order to get long-term gains?
Well, I suppose there is sort of different ways of looking at this. One of them is, if you're a party in government and you have a commitment to that party's long-term legacy, you want them to be in power for a long time, or they want them to be in power again, you don't want to store up problems for the future. So, you know, kicking these issues down the road, hoping that they will blow up on somebody else's watch, is quite risky, because we do attribute competence. You know, that's really important in how we react to the parties. Do we think there's been a massive mess up? So that's a game of chicken. Are you going to leave these complicated issues just to fester? I think there's a parallel with what I was saying about the advice I would give to the Conservative Party. I made a programme about ethnic minority voters a few years ago, and I talked about how, as the ethnic minority population is growing, the Conservatives couldn't afford to ignore them. And I think it's the same with young voters. Yes, this election, maybe that's fine. What about the one after that and the one after that?
I love this idea, Paula, which is the idea that if Rishi Sunak could somehow go back in time to 2010 and say to David Cameron, look, I'm going to be standing in an election in 2024. Can you please do these things? Because then that would be a great thing to do. Unfortunately, time travel is not one of his many attributes. There's a gentleman over there at the end.
David. My great-great-grandfather was Charles Grey, who moved the Reform Bill in the 1830s. Do we think there's an appetite for more reform, perhaps proportional representation and an elected second chamber?
I actually got into a university on the basis of my answer of a question about the 1832 Reform Bill, so many props to your ancestor. Who'd like to take this one on, Ron?
I can field this one because I've written a little bit about this on and off in the last year or so. And I think the answer is rather inconveniently yes and no. So yes, there clearly is more appetite for reforming the electoral system in polling than was traditionally the case in the past. And also this is true institutionally within, in particular, the Labour Party. Both the membership, the unions, much more supportive of it than they were at any point in the past. On the other hand, if we come back to that nerdy word salience or importance, it's really quite low down the list for voters. So the challenge for electoral reformers is always to enable voters to see that this is actually an issue that they should care about, because nerds like me care about it like day in, day out, but for average voters, it's not a quote-unquote bread-and-butter issue. So you have to find a way to link it to the bread-and-butter issues. Then you can get a discussion going.
We did actually do a programme fairly recently on reform of the House of Lords, and the leading constitutional expert, Meg Russell, gave an idea of the things that you could do to get, if you like, quick and dirty House of Lords reform, suggesting that that was the thing that if you wanted to change things, you would have to do, because anything bigger than that would be a terrific problem. Anyway, that's an invitation to find that episode on our podcast series on BBC Sounds. Yes, please.
Marta, we spoke about, obviously, a sort of botched Brexit and how immigration isn't a top priority for current voters. A, are they linked? Has the Brexit disappointment that the Leave campaign obviously pushed this fear of immigration, and then seeing that Brexit happened and immigrants are everywhere, I am one of them, and, you know, the sun still rises in the morning and everything is fine. And B, are there any statistics about Brexit voting regret?
An interesting question, and subsumed in that is maybe the suggestion that actually the question of taking back control actually really was the most important thing for many Leave voters, Paula.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect Rob wants to say something about that, so I'll leave that bit for him, but I'll take on the bit about Brexit regret. Now, for a really long time after the referendum, you could ask people how they would vote a second time, and they would just say the same thing. Nobody changed their minds for a really, really long time. We are starting to see a little bit of movement, but we shouldn't overstate it. And I think what we need to be really careful with, what some work we've been doing at UK and a Change in Europe shows, is that regret is not the same as wanting to rejoin the EU, and we shouldn't necessarily just conflate those two things together. So some people might now say, well, Brexit hasn't turned out how I wanted it to. Many of them will blame the government or other politicians for that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they've changed to wanting to rejoin. It doesn't mean it's changed their fundamental understanding of the question.
I'm really sorry, but we've only got time for one more question. Lots of people have wanted to ask questions. Somebody will already have a microphone in their hand. So if you would like to ask your question, sir.
Good evening. My name's Glyn. Advice has been given to the Conservative Party and to the Labour Party, two dominant parties. What advice would the panel have for the Liberal Democrats? Can they be disruptors in a climate where one could argue, is there a much difference between Labour and Conservative?
Okay, well, you don't necessarily have to answer that last point, which would probably get us into trouble if you did, but the first point can be answered, Rosie.
I'm really loath to give predictions, but I think this could be a lovely setting for the Liberal Democrats because, you know, there are quite a few constituencies where they are second placed and they haven't got the complexity that the Labour Party and the Conservative Party have of having this kind of divided electorate around Remain and Leave. They are the party of Remain. And I think when you have these kind of blue wall constituencies where there are voters who supported Remain and are fed up with the Conservatives, they've got a really nice, clear narrative. I don't know how it will pan out, but I would suggest that they can focus on those kind of constituencies and gain quite a lot.
I agree, but the risk from history is that their reach exceeds their grasp. So the other thing I would say if I was advising the Liberal Democrats is be focused, be disciplined. Don't try and compete in 100 seats because then you'll risk not winning in any of them. Focus on gaining the 10 or 15 or 20 best prospects, because in the long run, structural change in many of those blue wall seats is running in your favour. So just try and keep building up patiently, and maybe don't do another coalition with the Conservatives if it's out of Parliament.
Thank you for that. Thank you all very much indeed. I'm afraid that is actually all we do have time for. My thanks to Paula Surridge, Professor of Political Sociology at the University of Bristol, Rosie Campbell, Professor of Politics at King's College London, and Rob Ford, Professor of Political Science at the University of Manchester. The Briefing Room will be back next week. From everyone at the Radio Theatre, goodbye.
Who's in the news for all the wrong reasons? Step inside the world of crisis management and so-called spin doctors with me, David Yelland.
And me, Simon Lewis. In our new podcast from BBC Radio 4, we tell you what's really going on behind the scenes as the week's biggest PR disasters unfold.
Simon and I used to be on opposite sides of a story in the media when I was editor of The Sun and Simon was communications secretary to the late Queen. Now we've teamed up to share everything we know about what's keeping those big stories in and out of the press.
As the great philosopher King Mike Tyson himself once said, everyone has a plan until they're punched in the mouth.
And there's a lot of people punching people in the mouth in this town.
Listen and subscribe to When It Hits the Fan on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.